Just today comes a glimmer of hope for an end to war in Afghanistan. American and Taliban negotiators announced an agreement to a framework for discussing peace. That's a long way from actually ending war, which Afghanistan has known nearly nonstop for decades, which makes it an unlikely place to do a lot of things, including wildlife conservation. But that's exactly why our next guest went there a decade ago. Alex Dagan is the author of the book The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation. Alex Dagan is an evolutionary biologist and the former chief scientist at the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. He's the co-founder and current CEO of Conservation X Labs, which focuses on ending human-caused extinction. Alex Dagan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
As I look at your resume, there's a lot of international relations mixed in here with the conservation work. What kinds of things did you do at the State Department?
Yeah, so I actually started, I was going to be a professor at, in terms of conservation and evolutionary biology and understanding extinction. But three years after coming back, living in a tent in Madagascar, within a week of coming back to the United States, 9/11 happened. And I decided at that time I couldn't just spend my life in academia. Joined up with the State Department a short time after, and within 3 months of getting to the State Department, was sent to Iraq to redirect former weapons scientists. And then from there went on to the policy planning staff at the State Department, worked in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs, worked on under Obama, under engagement with the Islamic world, and then served as part of the team that was engaging Iran, as well as working on Afghanistan under Ambassador Dennis Ross and Richard Holbrooke. So it was definitely an interesting ride.
I should point out that you also have a law degree in addition to your science degrees, right?
I have a schizophrenic personality for sure in terms of all the areas that I love, but law was useful because it provides the fundamental structure of the social contract between societies. And understanding that element of it gave me really good insights in terms of how to better protect wildlife.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when you deal with things like the law, that's when you recognize things like international boundaries. But when you're dealing with wildlife, you realize those are things that don't recognize international boundaries.
That's exactly right. One of the areas our teams went into was the border between Afghanistan and China. And one of the interesting things about the border is it's the one area in the world where when you cross that border, you have to reset your watch by 3.5 hours because Afghanistan's on its own central time. And that has this one spit that reaches out and touches China, which is in the western part of China, as far away from Beijing, which the entire Beijing time, which the entire country is on. We were pretty sure that if we got too close to that border, we'd be shot at. But it is weeks of riding on yaks and horses and other pack animals to get to that point on the Afghan side. And when we were there, there was nothing but Marco Polo sheep who were just running across that border as if nothing was there.
Well, yeah, the sheep get to do it. The people don't. So just in terms of working in a place like Afghanistan, though, Alex, is it hard to get the rest of the world to remember that there are things like wildlife and natural areas in Afghanistan?
That is a great question. And I think, you know, this was actually a really important impetus for writing the book, was that the images we have of Afghanistan in the media, I think, are very limited. And Afghanistan, some people may know, was a cultural Silk Road. It was, you know, the lines of trade between the East and West went right through the heart of it, as well as other parts of Central Asia. But it was also this biological Silk Road, and it unites animals, you know, flora and fauna from Eurasia, from Africa, from Indo-Malaysia in the single country. And it's got this incredible range of habitats and terrains, from, you know, the western end of the Himalayas to deep, beautiful deserts to verdant woodlands that are on the border of Pakistan. And all those areas provide incredible habitat to a diversity of species, things like the Marco Polo sheep, which I like to call the Princess Leia sheep because they're the largest of the mountain sheep. They have horns that are 6 feet long if you follow the curve of those horns. to snow leopards, to Persian leopards, to caracals and lynxes and palace cats, to hyenas and brown bears and black bears within a single country. It's a spectacular place, and we don't see that imagery on the media.
So obviously work to do there. You went in 2006. How stable or not was the country then for people?
It was at a point when, after the initial invasion, there was a lot of stability in the country. But 2006 was a period when things started getting worse. And in particular, 2008, they recognized that the NGOs, or what they would call the soft targets, were really good targets to actually undermine confidence in the government, because they're the ones that were working on, you know, building up the education systems, building up the civil society, building up, you know, restoration of water or food security, things that you need as part of that social contract. So things became more difficult for us moving on. But at the same time, Afghanistan was actually the easiest place I've done conservation in the world, despite the presence of landmines and insecurity in a lot of them.
Easiest how?
It was because, you know, somewhere between 70 and 80% of the people there are dependent on natural resources. There was an understanding of how protection and better management of those resources were important for the people's survival as much as that of the wildlife. Most of the people actually have, you know, livestock. In some of the places where we work, that livestock was what was the key to their survival. So when the rangelands, which, you know, we have throughout the West, fail, it failed for both things like the Marco Polo sheep, the prey base for the snow leopards, as well as for the very animals and sheep that were keeping the people alive that was there.
All right, we have to take a short break here. The book is called The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation by Alex Dagan. We'll come back and talk more with Alex in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about Afghanistan today, but in a context unlike any you're likely to ever hear, because when people think about the many challenges that face the people of Afghanistan, wildlife conservation is not necessarily the first thing that comes to mind, but it did for Alex Dagan, who is both a lawyer and an evolutionary biologist and the former chief scientist at USAID. He now runs Conservation X Labs, which focuses on ending human-caused extinction. He's the author of a book called The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation. It focuses primarily on Afghanistan, but mentions other countries as well. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's continue to unpack this. You say that Afghanistan is actually one of the easiest places to do conservation because of the people. They realize that their livelihoods depend upon the natural resources.
Yeah. The other element that was really important is you've got to remember that 5 to 6 million people in Afghanistan were refugees in other countries. For 30 years, the Soviet invasion was in 1979. It was followed by a civil war against the Taliban, which ultimately took control, then followed by the U.S. invasion after 9/11. And for those people, right, if you are growing up in Pakistan or you're growing up in Iran, you're growing up in the Emirates or even growing up in Europe, wherever you could go, for those people, you know, helping them regain and strengthen that sense of identity was critical. And we made that argument that actually protecting the wildlife by protecting these ecosystems that are uniquely Afghan in some ways, because they're this amalgamation of different ecosystems from different parts of the world in a single country, mixed furiously among mountains and forests and this incredible terrain and wetlands that were there, that this was a way to actually protect people's identity, to restore what it meant to be Afghan. And one of the things we just found with people related with the wildlife, it's something you see out west, on the walls of their houses, you would see paintings of Marco Polo's sheep and ibex, and the names, you know, would call out to the names of big cats. At one point, you know, it was entirely likely that Afghanistan had more cat species, or at least almost as many cat species as all of sub-Saharan Africa. This is something you don't, again, see in the media. There were tigers in Afghanistan up until 1960s. There still may be cheetahs in Afghanistan. There's a probability of lions that existed in the south in the 1920s or earlier. Some of those species, like the tigers and the Asiatic lion, are gone. The cheetah may be gone, but there's still an amazing amount of wildlife still left in the country. And by making that argument, it was a lot less painless than many of the other places I worked around the world. In terms of that, of understanding the importance of conservation within what they're doing. The other flip side of it was it allowed us to actually achieve goals that we wanted to achieve in the rebuilding of the country. And one of which was, you know, how do you rebuild governance? And the ability to build civil society and the rule of law and governance is hard to do in the abstract. The idea of democracy is easier for us because we see it in practice. It is not just within our national government. It is implemented in every way in our lives. But when you have been devoid of it for so long, giving sort of substance to something that is almost ethereal is hard. And it was actually the management committees that brought together the national, regional, and local governments and elected representatives from the villages around the national parks we were building that made them so incredibly successful and that worked. And when I was recounting some of the, because every time I would talk to other people working on democracy or human rights or education, they would sort of scoff at the idea of conservation in Afghanistan until they realized it was actually a really effective way to give meaning and substance to these concepts that they themselves were having trouble with.
So did the State Department at all see value in what you were doing for their purposes as well?
I mean, we were funded by USAID. So this was from the American people to the people of Afghanistan. And I think one of the things we don't see is just the value, how much our science and technology, how much things like conservation can actually be a bridge on which our official relationships can rest. And the value of things like our development assistance and humanitarian assistance. We're an incredibly generous country, both through our private donations as well as through the official work of the U.S. government to do this. So State Department definitely saw this, and even the U.S. military very much came on board with our efforts and were huge successors behind what we're doing. Obviously, USAID funded the project. They were the first donor to get behind the project, which is why we had the opportunity to be there.
Alex Dagan is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation, focused primarily on Afghanistan. You had known adversity in the field before. You described some work in Russia and Madagascar, and you did mention Iraq earlier. These kind of toughened you up and got you ready for a place like Afghanistan, it sounds like.
It was useful to work in places in the midst of change. And anyone who's served, I think, as a veteran in Iraq or Afghanistan or former Yugoslavia, those places become highly addictive. But they also teach you a whole set of skills that I think are useful. You know, the adaptability that it takes to be able to solve these problems, the ability to get the resources that you need to build relationships across organizations to make things work in sort of remote settings. So, my biggest adversities in Madagascar were just, you know, I got malaria multiple times, schistosomiasis, giardia. We had to deal with, you know, working a day's walk from the nearest road for literally a number of years in a row. In order to do that research, the whole logistical operation that it was involved to keep 22 field assistants and you know 50 members of the local communities that were working with us alive was incredibly useful in places like Afghanistan. So was working in Iraq, where you know I was working on one of the first State Department programs under the Coalition Provisional Authority, and every day we were out. We were trying to redirect former weapon scientists, which meant actually rebuilding civilian science. And that meant being out among the scientists, among the universities every day outside of the green zone. And that gave me real insights into how to keep people safe. And that was kind of the, you know, I have a lot of white hair from just thinking about how do you deal with people who are 3 weeks out by yak to a field site. How do I make sure that I do everything possible to keep them safe and so they have the training and resources so they can also save themselves until we can get help to them? And that is not an easy process. If someone's batteries go out, we had multiple redundant systems on, you know, they were expected to text back every day, you know, and reach back out to us. But if something happened to them, the solar panels failed or something happened to them, you know, how many days do we wait before we spend a few hundred thousand dollars to activate high altitude helicopters, which were necessary to get to those sites and try to figure out where they are in a gigantic landscape and be able to save them? You know, in the places we were working, the remoteness of those places were as much of a threat as anything else. And in fact, in many of the places, it wasn't really the Taliban or insurgencies. Getting to those places was, but it was once you were there, it was dealing with the remoteness that you would find in the Sierras in terms of being able to reach people and rescue them.
Mm-hmm. So 3 days by yak could easily have been the title of the book, it sounds like.
Yeah, that was the original title that I wanted, which was nixed by my publisher. Was the Snow Leopard startup, and the reason they nixed it was it sounded too much like the Apple OS, and they thought people would get confused, you know, that it was a guide to the operating system, when in fact it was, it really felt like actually like a startup in terms of we had 30 days. When we walked into the country, we didn't have permission to even be in the country as an NGO. So we had 30 days to pull together the permission, get the vehicles, the teams, and everything else we needed to be able to get those people into the middle of the western of the Himalayas, the Pamir Mountain, literally an area called the Pamir Knot, because you have all these mountains, the Kunlun, the Tian Shan, the Hindu Kush, the Pamirs that are crashing together, sort of like the intersection of different currents and waves that create this massive amount of topography that has been able to preserve some of the planet's most incredible wildlife and wildlands.
The book is called The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation, focused mainly on Afghanistan, where Alex Dagan works starting in 2006. He is a lawyer. He is also an evolutionary biologist. He currently runs a place called Conservation X Labs, which focuses on ending human-caused extinction. You can join our conversation on The Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Guy in Mendocino. Thanks for joining the Jefferson Exchange.
I just wanted to comment. About 20 years ago, I read a book written by an Englishman called A Short Walk in the Hindu Kush. And it was written, I don't know the year, but it was written before there were the current wars with the, you know, the Russians and the Americans. And this guy just spent about a month walking and observing and interacting with the people in the mountains. And his observations gave me the impression of what a beautiful country Afghanistan is, how rough, how rugged, but how lush also, with lots of food, fruit growing, farmers farming and working the land and making a go of it, and how tough the people are, and how independent, fiercely independent. It was just an image of Afghanistan and of that region in general that you certainly don't get. You know, all you hear about is war and fighting and war. So that's just my observation. So I can see how as he painted a picture of such a beautiful and fertile country with lots of water, rushing mountain streams and rivers, that I can see that there certainly would be a need to take into consideration the wildlife that live there as well.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Guy. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. So let me ask you this, Alex. How beat up is the environment from war in Afghanistan? Or do we have a wrong impression that the whole country is just, you know, devastated by war?
So it's always more complex than you think. I just one comment, A Short Walk in the Hindu Kush is an amazing book. It was published it was written by Eric Newby in 1958. And in particular, he was in Nuristan, which is one of the areas we were working on the ground, which Alexander the Great thought the people were followers of Dionysus because they all have all these amazing sort of unique cultural attributes, that sort of separate them from other parts of Afghanistan that even individual valleys did. And the people were just, you know, they're incredible. One of the things about Afghans, are that they are incredibly beautiful people, and it's an amazing culture, and it's a diverse culture across the whole place. In terms of how beat up the environment is, it's mixed, right? In some places, things like mines and the potential of hostilities helps actually protect wildlife and wildlands, and in fact, what we thought were, you know, we believed that there was something like only 70 snow leopards left in Afghanistan. But in the end, the research showed just at least in Badakhshan province, there was over 200 snow leopards and perhaps more in other parts of the country. So you have that effect. The other effect that you have is you have just the mass degradation of the landscape. And in fact, in some places, in Afghanistan, it's almost like there's a new geological era, epoch, because there is so many shell casings and so much disturbance. I jokingly was calling it the Bellocene, sort of like the Anthropocene, but you know, the new era that was just created by 30 years of warfare on a landscape that you can see. And in fact, if you go out to Moscow, you can still see the trenches that are left in the woods from where, you know, the Germans were outside of the city. And again, these things sort of persist. But I think there's two things that were sort of major threats. One was just, you know, when you have a war, you have a lot of guns. And when you have a lot of guns, that's generally not a great thing for wildlife. The second thing is just the collapse of the rule of law, you know, whether it was implemented by the king, and the last king of Afghanistan, Zahir Shah, was an incredible advocate for the environment, and many of these protected areas were lands that he set aside as his, you know, personal hunting reserves. But like in many cases, hunters and fishermen are amazing conservation advocates, and that was the case with Zahir Shah, and they were close to being declared national parks in the 1970s if it were not for the interruption of the war. But the other aspect has actually been the more recent presence of people in the country, particularly the humanitarian and military forces. And this was really perhaps without thought, where we were finding an incredible demand for furs that wasn't there before, that was being driven by the very people who are in Afghanistan to actually help it. And one of the things we started doing was working with the U.S. military, working with the NATO ISAF forces, as well as working with to shut down illegal fur trade that was going on those bases or going on adjacent to those bases. And then actually started working more seriously with people in the Afghan government, such as at the airport, to actually shut down trade there. And one of the effects of which was I would start missing my planes because they were so proud of all the seizures they had made and wanted to show me every one of them, and I wasn't about to dissuade them. But for a long time, when you flew into the old airport, the only signs you would see coming in and out of the airport were the signs that we had made up to help spread the word that a lot of these species are protected, that what, you know, buying a snow leopard comforter, which some people, you know, were seeking to do, was illegal under Afghan law, international law, as well as under, you know, the laws of the countries that you were coming from. And that helped change the tide. But the best part was the Afghan shopkeepers themselves that were selling some of these products, you know, themselves asked, you know, for help in understanding which species needed to be protected that they needed not to start trading in. And that was the very last thing I did in the country was train some of those shopkeepers. And it brought tears to my eyes. When they first called me up and they said, "Hey, you've really damaged our business. We want to talk to you." I was pretty sure that I was about to be shot. We didn't have guns. Our program didn't work with weapons of any kind because we wanted to change how people saw us. I took the meeting anyway, and they came in and they said, "We would love to go through this training you've provided to all these others."
Wow.
And it was one of my best moments in the country.
The book is called The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation by Alex Dagan about his time in Afghanistan. We'll come back and hear more about it in just a moment on The Exchange, and you're welcome to join us by phone and email. Back on The Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about wildlife conservation in a context you may never have anticipated. Alex Dagan performed wildlife conservation efforts with a group in Afghanistan starting in 2006. So just 5 years after the American invasion was when his project started. He's written a book about that and some other adventures in the backcountry. It's called The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Kara in Eugene. Thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, I'm enjoying the conversation. And you mentioned the role of protecting the native species and how that's help the people with their identity as they're coming back to the country. And I'm wondering about the role of protecting these species because they're kind of, you know, they're charismatic, they're beautiful things we care about. How do you see this kind of conservation efforts in war zones as also a bonding kind of attractive kind of effort to get people to care about these issues of the war in Afghanistan as a kind of a doorway in also to it? Attract people to care about the issue.
Diplomacy through animals, a good point. Thanks.
Yeah,
for that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, thanks for that, Kara. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very powerful force. People get exhausted with sort of the stories of war and terrorism and the challenges that we face in so many different countries around the world. So having different insight into people of the country, into wildlife or the geology, which is also really spectacular in this country, I think is a very powerful force to generating empathy, to generating support for, you know, why we are in some of these places that we are. And I think it also generates really positive support for the United States. It's not only makes, our views more empathetic to countries like Afghanistan that have an incredible diversity of people and landscapes and fauna and flora, but they also work to better promote relations among us. This was the Bronx Zoo in New York, the Wildlife Conservation Society, that was leading this effort. And it was, you know, when we lead with science, when we lead with conservation, we lead with some of the best of the United States. We lead with our best intentions and our best hopes and our best goals to promote international development. And I think that also changes the tenure of relationships. One of the things that, I got asked the other night, did you suffer from corruption from a Marine who was stationed in Helmand who was asked for bribes constantly? And the incredible story was we had no problems with corruption during the time I was there, which I found really amazing. And I think part of the reason was we had so much support from people from the most local levels to the provincial to the national for what we were trying to do, that made our job really easy. And it was clear that we were trying to act with the people and for the people, as well as for their wildlife and for the identity. This wasn't conservation in sort of a neocolonial sense. This was conservation through co-creation and an understanding of shared goals.
But Alex, it's conservation in a country where obviously there's been interruptions in normal processes, at least in terms of where how humans relate to each other. So, I mean, you probably have a lot of eons old traditional knowledge. There's modern wildlife conservation science. But how well did anybody understand the ecosystems of Afghanistan as you got in there?
I mean, this is actually a huge benefit, is actually being able to tap into that, right? And so when people are, when you have a country like Afghanistan where 70 to 80% of the people are dependent on natural resources for their survival, they have pretty good insights, actually, that those natural resources, you know, are in how to manage them and what to manage. And they're receptive to the messaging that we have. They're also incredibly hospitable people, and they I slept in people's floors in some places because that was actually the safest place for us to be. We didn't, again, have armored cars. We didn't have guns when we were traveling through these areas. There were security concerns throughout, but that was that. And, you know, in some places, we couldn't work at all. The far south, we really couldn't work within what we're doing. But people fundamentally understood it. The challenge is, you've got 5 to 6 million refugees coming back, issues of land tenure, issues of how to rebuild a country. And part of it, it was making sure that doing so in a way that was sustainable for the long term was what everyone was doing. And helping the Afghans own that management of those natural resources was important. People remember, those with longer memories, that in 1979, tourism was the number two source of income for that country. It was a really popular stop for many tourists traveling through Asia. And for many people, it was one of their favorite places that they went. So there is an opportunity to rebuild the country, particularly now given the peace deal, or the potential for participation in the negotiations. We're not at a peace deal yet, that hopefully can bring stability to the country, because it is a spectacular place. And some places like Wakhan, which is that peninsula that was literally a barrier set up between the Russians and the British during the Great Game, you can get to from Kazakhstan. And there are, 7,000-meter mountains there, 20,000-foot-plus feet high mountains that are unclimbed, that are pristine, that are still wild, that are some of the most incredible trekking areas on this planet, that people can go. And when people start getting a benefit from conservation, they have the incentives to protect it. Because one of the challenges we have is we ask those people who can least afford the cost of conservation to bear its greatest cost. And upon us to actually help change those incentives.
Tell us about the area called Bande Amir, and there are some dams there, and they're not the kinds of dams we're used to hearing about. This is a really fascinating place.
Yeah, Bande Amir is spectacular. It is 60 miles from where the Buddhas were. It's on something called the Hazarjat Plateau, which is like a fist of mountains that plunge into the center of the country. And it is a set of six dams that are created by the same process that forms stalactites and slagmites, supersaturated calcium carbonate in the water. So if you've been to Mammoth Hot Springs and you've seen those shallow pools that are sort of edged by, rimmed by those deposits of minerals, imagine that, except the dams that are formed are on the feet of upwards of 60 feet or more. And so you have something that looks like the Grand Canyon, where, again, the rim of that those canyons are at 9,000, 8,000 feet, and then surrounded by this turquoise blue water, edged with sort of this brilliant white sort of stalactite-like calcium carbonate deposits that form this series of dams. And then you have a two partially carved Buddhas that were never finished and abandoned on the edge of a lake, one of the holiest religious shrines at the edge of the lake, and then Persian leopards and ibex darting around it. And then one other bonus, which is the top of those mountains are actually filled with marine fossils, because at one point this was the bottom of a shallow ocean, potentially the Tethys Sea that was there at the time. So it is a spectacular place. And, you know, it was the location of the first national park in 2009. In Afghanistan in its history. And the best part about it is the majority of the tourists that are going there are Afghans, but they themselves, you know, value and appreciate this spectacular site.
You talked about how people are in understanding of the need to keep the land going. And if they depend upon grazing, for example, they want to make sure there's something for their cattle to graze on or whatever their livestock is. But there are things like the opium trade where people use the land in ways because they can make a lot of money in a short amount of time without a whole lot of care for what happens beyond this crop. I mean, did you find a lot of that too?
Yeah, I mean, this was the opium problem is unfortunate and difficult, right? And it affects things in different ways. I mean, one of our policies was to pay people not to grow opium, and the inadvertent effect of that was everyone stopped planting what they were planting before and started planting opium, so they'd then get paid not to grow opium. So part of it is driven by that. But we were affected, really. We saw two ways this was affected. In this place called Badakhshan, which is where the Wakhan Peninsula is, the province where the Wakhan Peninsula is, it's also the place that lapis lazuli came out of, which makes up the blue in King Tut's mask. And in terms of his funerary ornamentation, and this was a place of this incredible gemstone that traveled all over the world. That's the same area. One of the problems was that as people got addicted to opium, they would trade their wealth, which was their livestock, to the dealers, but still be obligated to take care of the livestock on behalf of the dealers. And when you stop owning something, you're going to manage the natural resources in a worse way. And that was a huge issue in terms of the areas that we were. The other area was we went, George Schaller, was myself and others, went to go look for the Asiatic cheetah in the western part of the country. And the places where we and this is right now the world's most endangered cat species, or in this case specifically cat subspecies, and we really couldn't get into the areas where we thought it was. The population of this animal is only somewhere around 40 species in Iran, and when you get down to numbers that low, random chance events, you know, a litter that is born of mostly males, or you know, a series of car accidents can literally wipe a species out to extinction. If you guys remember, the California condor got down to extremely low numbers like that, and you become at risk of falling into this extinction vortex. We couldn't get into those areas because the drug smugglers that would pass from Afghanistan into Iran, and they've also created an addiction problem in Iran as well, were so well armed that they outgunned the Afghan military and police forces that were traveling around with us, and they were unwilling to go into some of these areas that we were looking for. So those are some of the ways. We also just had, you know, we had some very strategic thoughts about how to deal with this. We got Land Rovers, Land Cruisers, those cruisers are delivered to us white, which was the color of the UN. We specifically painted them blue to look closer like the smugglers, the drug smugglers, so we would actually be less likely to be attacked, which was sort of paradoxical training in terms of how do we reduce our profile and not look like a subject of attack. We would have to drive through poppy fields, and we were really careful, keep our eyes looking straight forward, because we didn't want to look like we were there to intercede in terms of the of that trade, just trying to move through some of those landscapes that we were working on. And then I think things like the poppy trade undermine, ultimately contribute to corruption and undermine the rule of law. So, and that has an effect on other things like the wildlife.
We just about half a minute left, Alex, and I wonder if you're more optimistic perhaps about the future of the wildlife in Afghanistan than some of the people.
You know, I'm optimistic about both, because I think these are people who have survived, and this is wildlife that have survived, you know, 30 years of war and have still maintained their optimism and their hope. And I think our hope for the country is not to abandon them, as we did once before, that led to the rise of the Taliban, but for us to continue to support all aspects of Afghanistan, whether human or wildlife.
It's a fascinating story. We didn't even get into the part about how Alex ended up talking to the ambassador from Iran, which you're really not supposed to do, but there's a lot to the book. It's called The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation. Alex Dagan is both a lawyer and an evolutionary biologist, CEO and co-founder of Conservation X Labs, which focuses on ending human-caused extinction. Alex, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.